Welcome to the Florida Roundup here on Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami. My co-host Melissa Ross is off this week. More than half of Florida's public school children have to wear a mask to school. At least 13 school boards have approved a mask requirement despite a state's efforts to prohibit such rules and threats of funding cuts by the State Board of Education. In fact, this week, Commissioner Richard Corcoran started holding back money equal to the salaries of school board members and superintendents in the first two school districts that put in place mask mandates. Corcoran contends the rules are against state law. But on Thursday this week, a circuit court judge entered his final written decision in a court challenge finding the school mask mandates are legal. Governor Ron DeSantis then appealed that decision. As the case continues making its way through the justice system, hundreds of thousands of Florida school children have to wear masks to school and in the classroom, in the hallways. From the peninsula to the panhandle, Miami-Dade to Leon, Gulf Coast to the First Coast, Sarasota to Duval, A to V, Alachua to Volusia, school boards in democratically dominated counties and strong Republican areas have approved rules requiring a doctor's note if a child is to go without a mask in class in a Florida public school. So politics and public health here on this Friday on the Florida Roundup, parents' rights and the ability for local officials to make rules. How to find that balance between personal freedom and maintaining healthy public schools. Our phone lines open now, 305-995-1800, 305-995-1800. Parents, teachers, students, we want to hear from you, 305-995-1800 at Florida Roundup on Twitter. Vicki Cartwright is with us, the interim superintendent at the Broward County Public School District here in South Florida. Superintendent Cartwright, welcome to the Florida Roundup. Thanks for your time.
Thank you very much for having me this afternoon.
The Florida Board of Education Commissioner Richard Corcoran began holding back funding equal to the salaries of your school board and you. How much money?
So actually, it's not the superintendent's salary. So my salary is not impacted by this. However, they did go ahead and garnish the salaries for all nine of my board members. They did that on August the 26th through about $35,000, a little bit more than that.
$35,000 a month.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right?
That is correct.
And is that making any material impact on funding for Broward County schools and the service provided to students or the ability to pay for services and teachers?
So what they did is we're not allowed to locate funding that would have any impact on teacher salaries or resources to our students. So we haven't done that. But the federal government did step in yesterday, actually, and creating a fact sheet to support school districts for the American Rescue Plan. And included in there, it stated that it's in response to our questions and such, that we do have the ability to use our American Rescue Plan funds in order to ensure that our school board members continue to get paid.
Have you received those federal funds?
No one in the state of Florida has received these funds yet, but we are allowed to go ahead and start allocating the funding out of the amount that we know we're supposed to be receiving and go ahead and start utilizing those dollars.
We'll think about it as anticipatory spending. And will you spend those dollars on the missing salaries for the school board members?
That is our intention at this point, yes.
Let's talk about the virus then in Broward County schools. How many students have opted out of masks with a doctor's note?
So we don't, and that's with the doctor's note, what we've done is we actually ran that through the federal programs. So we run it through our Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, IDEA. So we're looking at students to see if they qualify for like an IEP, if they need accommodations. Mm-hmm. But moreover, it's Section 504 of the American Disability Act. And so right now, if they're coming in and they don't have an IEP or a 504 plan, then what we do is we go ahead and we are allowing them to come in without the mask with the doctor's note. But in short order, we're taking it through that formal process because to determine whether or not they really have a need in order to have that accommodation. So we're just keeping everything as logistically possible and streamlined. So that way it prevents some of the things that we're seeing around the state where like a chiropractor is writing medical notes for students needing not to wear a mask.
Yeah, there have been reports in parts of Florida where a doctor of chiropractic has written mask notes for students. So, here we are several weeks into the school year, Superintendent. How many students are able to go without a mask and have received the proper exemption?
So I don't have an exact count on that just yet, but I can tell you that, frankly speaking, a lot of our students and our parents, they want their children to be wearing the mask. We had previously made this available as far as going through the 504 or the IEP process last school year. Mm-hmm. So we already had in place for those families because of a disability where a child cannot wear a mask. We'd already been previously doing that. So we haven't really seen a huge uptick in those requests right now.
We're speaking with Vicki Cartwright, Interim Superintendent, Broward County Public Schools, one of the more than a dozen county public school districts in Florida that have approved mask mandates for students. 305-995-1800. Coming up in moments, we'll be speaking with the chairwoman of the Sarasota County School Board, and a little bit later on, the chair of the Duval County Public School Board. Want your phone calls, though. Maurice in Jacksonville, you are up first. Go ahead, Maurice. You're on the radio.
Hey, thank you very much. I'm just curious, you know, what precedent had been set, or what's the basis, or why would school officials want to step in and make medical decisions such as we need to mask kids?
Fair enough, Maurice. Let's put that to Superintendent Cartwright. What drew you as the superintendent and your school board to enter into this mask policy quagmire that has turned out to be kind of a legal tangle between local school districts and the state?
Sure. So that is a very good question. Here in Broward County, our positivity rate was really high and continues to be extremely high. Our hospitalization rates here for ICU beds, for even in the pediatric unit, is over 90% of them are full. So the capacity is very limited. My board takes the safety and their constitutionally the rights, what they have in the Florida Constitution, very seriously. They are responsible for creating that safe environment for our students, as well as for our staff members as well. And so what happened is that we looked at the Parents' Bill of Rights that was out there. And, you know, there's two portions of that policy. And the governor, while he's talking towards the first half, the second half, which is what Judge Cooper is talking about, was not in play. In other words, it has to be necessary.
Superintendent, Judge Cooper is the Leon County Circuit Court judge that ruled that local school districts in Florida could, in fact, have mask requirements for students. The state contends that Broward County and others are violating this Parents' Bill of Rights, a law that was recently signed within the last 3-4 months into law by Governor DeSantis. That law says that parents have the fundamental right to, quote, direct the upbringing, education, and care of their minor children. So go on further why you believe, and others have stated that they do not believe these local school board mask policies violate state law, whereas the State Board of Education has found cause that your policy in your district does violate law.
Sure. So in this, what happens is if a policy affects the parents' right to control their children's education or health and is adopted by the district, what is supposed to happen is that if there is somebody who wants to challenge that, then at that point in time, they can challenge it. What we are responsible for is ensuring that the policy is reasonably necessary to achieve a compelling state interest, mm-hmm. and that the policy is narrowly tailored and not otherwise served by a less restrictive means. So that's the second half of that bill. And what the court is advising us in essence is that when the order came in and the governor put in the order, and then the Department of Education as well as the Department of Health came in, basically what's happening is it's not allowing districts to show that the policy is reasonable and meets the requirements.
Yeah. We have a tweet from a listener. Black Tuna sends us a note at Florida Roundup. It's almost like the governor didn't read past the first sentence of his own law. You can join the conversation, social media at Florida Roundup, or by calling 305-995-1800. Interim Superintendent Cartwright, thank you for your time today in sharing the experience of Broward County. Much appreciated.
Thank you very much.
Shirley Brown is with us now, the chair of the Sarasota County School Board. Chair Brown, thank you for your time in joining us.
Well, glad to be here.
The Sarasota School Board approved its mask requirement 2 weeks ago. The state announced it had launched an investigation, which could lead to the state holding back money. Are you prepared for that?
Well, you know, we are. We've answered that, again, saying that we believe that the parents' Bill of Rights, you know, gives us the ability to do this. I mean, because I think we did demonstrate a compelling state interest when we showed the numbers. And, you know, we've got like 40,000 kids or less than 40,000 students, and we had 1,000 of them test positive last week. You know, that's pretty rough. And, you know, and a lot of people are thinking, well, this isn't a big issue, but, you know, a third of all these new COVID cases with this Delta variant are for children under the age of 18. You know, it's our students that are getting this, and it's, you know, in our schools, and we have to adjust it. For every student that tests positive for COVID, there's a ripple effect. The students that are around that one that have to be quarantined. And then when we've got elementary students that have to be quarantined, well, then that's upsetting the family because somebody has to take off work to be home with them and then be the teacher for them for, you know, a week to 2 weeks.
Chair Brown, let me ask you, apologies for the interruption. You mentioned about 40,000 students in Sarasota County Public Schools. Is that number correct?
I think it's a
37,000, but you said 1,000 positive
in the public schools that we do. We also have charter schools, but
correct. I understand. Yeah. Traditional public schools. And you said 1,000 of those students have tested positive for COVID-19 since the beginning of the school year.
No, that was in 1 week.
In 1 week, 1,000 students testing positive.
We've got over 2,000 that have tested positive. And you know, what's surprising is that the majority of them are in elementary school.
And of course, right, for children under the age of 12, they are not eligible to receive a vaccine under the FDA's recommendations. How many students are quarantined?
We've got about the 5% of our students in quarantine now. I think somewhere around several thousand. I'm looking here and I've got some numbers, but these numbers aren't the same ones that I looked at yesterday that somebody printed out today for me. But
so about one out of every 20 students in Sarasota County traditional public schools have been quarantined. About 5%.
Yeah.
Yeah.
About 5% are not eligible to return today, 4.5.
Chair Brown, stick with us. We want to take a phone call from the Palm Coast. Stephanie has been very patient. Stephanie, you are now on the radio. Thanks for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My concern is that, you know, there are dress codes in schools. Kids have to wear shoes, but they, you know, you can police the shoulders of a 7-year-old for wearing spaghetti straps, but the governor is not willing to see the logic in a mask being no different than, you know, shoes and a standard hygiene issue.
Hmm. Yeah. Stephanie, appreciate you adding that voice there from Palm Coast. Chair Brown, Shirley Brown in Sarasota County, it was a 3-2 vote by your school board for the mask requirement. You supported it. You served in the Florida House as a Democrat. One of your colleagues who supported the mask rule has been supported by the Democratic Party. A third yes vote in that vote was from a school board member who had been a Republican but switched her party registration to Democrat. Yet the vote in Sarasota County has been characterized as a vote for masks in schools in a conservative county. Do you agree with that characterization?
Well, we've got some different philosophies, but, you know, I'm a registered Democrat and I served as a Democrat, but, you know, the issues that we're looking at aren't Democrat and Republican. I mean, we need to vote for the best interest of our children. And I don't think COVID is a Democrat or Republican issue.
Chairwoman Brown, thank you for sharing.
One of the problems we have is that, you know, one of our board members was very instrumental in passing the Parents' Bill of Rights and started the Moms for Liberty group that is doing a lot of the actions opposing this, the organized opposition to it.
Yeah.
And I know even last year she pulled her daughter, who was then a first grader, out of our public schools and put her into a private school because she opposed having her child to wear a mask.
Chair Brown, apologies for the interruption. I want to hear from one of your fellow chair persons in public school board service here in South Florida, and that is Elizabeth Anderson. She's the chair of the Duval County Public School Board. Chair Anderson, thank you for your time today. Your mask requirement in Duval takes effect on Tuesday. Parents and students have had a couple of weeks' notice. How many students have opted out?
So we don't have those final numbers yet. We are giving folks until Tuesday to get those numbers and forms in collaboration with their healthcare professional.
What's the state of the virus in Duval ahead of this mask requirement being put in place on Tuesday?
So to be honest with you, I'm really grateful that our numbers look like they are improving here locally. I know a few weeks ago, we were really in this North Florida area, the epicenter of some real serious outbreaks. I think at one point we were number three in the state. Our numbers in the community are coming down, which I think is promising for us. But as our healthcare reminders continue, our providers continue to remind me, our students and the hospitalizations, the health impacts will lag. And so unfortunately, you know, we're seeing 8 children admitted to our local pediatric hospital yesterday. We had a student pass away. So, you know, even though our community seems to be improving some, I still think this is a really important move to make sure that we are covering all our bases in our schools.
Chair Anderson, we have just about a minute left here, but I want to ask you about a lawsuit that's been filed against the Duval County School Board, arguing the constitutional rights of about 24 students have been violated. Some students suing have learning disabilities. How does the mask requirement impact students with learning disabilities?
So I don't want to comment too much on the particular lawsuit, of course, but I will say one of the reasons that it was important for us to make sure that families were able to make these decisions in collaboration with their healthcare providers or psychologists is to make sure that we are accommodating the needs for all children in our district.
And can you assure those 24 parents that are behind the lawsuit that their children are being accommodated?
Students were accommodated last year. I know Broward's going through their IEP and 504 process through IDEA to make sure that those needs are met. And we did that last year through for our students with disabilities. We have no intention to not continue to make sure that every child's needs are met to the best of our ability.
Elizabeth Anderson, chair of the Duval County Public School Board. Chair Anderson, thank you for your time.
Thank you so much.
And Chairwoman Brown, Shirley Brown in Sarasota County, thanks again for your time as well. As we continue to talk about COVID-19, school districts, the battle between school districts and state leaders over mask mandates, really just the latest longstanding power struggle between Tallahassee and local school boards. You can find a podcast about this. Just look for Tallahassee Takeover wherever you get your podcasts. Tallahassee Takeover is the search term. The Florida Roundup continues next. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup here on Florida Public Radio. Thanks for supporting public media in your community. I'm Tom Hudson. Melissa Ross is off this week. We've been living in a coronavirus pandemic for more than 18 months now. And during that time, the state of Florida has taken several approaches to how it reports COVID-19 infections and deaths. The Florida Department of Health has gone from daily reports to weekly reports, for instance. And last month, it changed the way it reports the number of people dying from COVID. State health officials used to report coronavirus deaths as they were notified someone died from the virus. Now they report deaths by the actual date that someone died. While it may not seem like too big of a change, it can take longer for someone dying from the germ to show up in the state's data. And that delay can create what may look like an inaccurate decrease in statewide COVID deaths. So we're talking about how to interpret the state's COVID data. Are you using the data to make decisions about where you go, what you do, and your behavior? Let us know at 305-995-1800, 305-995-1800. Share your experiences on social media. Find us on Twitter, at Florida Roundup. Sarah Blaski is with us, a data specialist and reporter for the Miami Herald. Sarah, nice to have you on the program. Thanks for your time.
Thanks so much for having me.
So please explain the change that happened in August in how the state reports those Floridians who have died from COVID-19.
Sure. So I think you did a pretty good job summarizing, but to highlight a couple of points. So the Florida Department of Health stopped publishing daily COVID-19 data in early June of this year, meaning that the only data available on a daily basis came from the CDC. Now that data is still collected by the Florida Department of Health, but it is published by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention on their website. And that data is the data specifically that we're talking about today, the daily numbers. In the past, the way those daily numbers were presented was, as you said, by the date of the report. So when that report was logged, as opposed to the date of death, which is how they do it now. Of course, there are reasons to do it both ways. They both serve purposes. Neither one is wrong in and of itself. But when you report by date of death, what that can mean is if you are using these numbers every day as sort of a snapshot and you look at the latest number from the day before on deaths and you think, huh, how does that compare to what I remember from the previous day? You could be being misled because those numbers at the end of the daily trends, the most recent numbers, if you are organizing your data by date of death, those will look like they are going down. Those numbers will always look like they are going down as data backfill over time. So just to sort of cap off here, well, doing it by report date also has its problems and isn't epidemiologically the best way to do it over the long term. It certainly is a good leading indicator of how trends are going. And so if you're comparing one number, that report date might be more helpful for you from the previous day.
So let me try to give you a kind of a hypothetical example. If someone's loved one passes away from COVID-19 today, as we're talking here on September 2nd, but that report is not received by the Department of Health until a week from today, for instance, on September 10th, that data point will appear in the graph for September 2nd when we're living in the reality of September 10th or 11th. Is that fair? Is that accurate description?
That's correct. And you can see why that would be helpful over the long term. You actually know when that person died. And so epidemiologists prefer doing death data by date of death, but not for real-time numbers. Yeah. If you want to know, you want a basic indicator, right? A quick litmus test for are deaths going up or down? The better thing is report date, because on that day, you will, at least the way that COVID-19 data have been traditionally, if the number by report date is up today from where it was yesterday, that's a pretty good indication, experts tell us, that, you know, deaths in general are on the rise or have been over the last 2 weeks.
One of those experts, Sarah, that I know you've spoken to frequently over the last 18 months is Jason Salemi. He's the University of South Florida epidemiologist. Professor, welcome back to Florida Public Media. Nice to have you again.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
So you've been tracking this COVID data really since the beginning of the pandemic. Which method of tracking COVID deaths is better to understand the virus and where it potentially may be going?
I think Sarah actually did a fantastic job of talking about the relative strengths and weaknesses of each approach. Again, just to recap, if we use deaths based on when they are recorded, as she alluded to, it is the closest thing to a real-time assessment of COVID-19 fatalities. The problem is they are so impacted by reporting lag. So for example, if we learned of 200 people who died from COVID-19 today, so that's how many were reported, more than half of those individuals may have actually died more than 2 weeks ago. And also what you notice when you look at deaths by date reported is you see an artificial decrease during the weekends. And it's not because people don't die from COVID-19 over the weekends. It's because certification and reporting move more slowly. And so that's why no matter what you use, it's important to focus on 7-day moving averages on these deaths to get the underlying trend. But unfortunately, the answer is you really would like to have both of these pieces of information. And in fact, on my Florida dashboard, I do present deaths by date reported right alongside deaths by date that they actually occurred. And this is why. I consulted with the National COVID Tracking Project last year when they did a deep dive into this issue across the nation. And their main recommendations was, and I even wrote it down because I want to quote it, all states should provide both sets of numbers. These are actually complementary types of data, each with its own strengths and drawbacks, and publishing both allows for easy comparisons while minimizing the risk of misinformation. And lastly, to go along the transparency of communication and making sure that people understand the data, they also stated that states should clearly mark date of death charts with the dates that are incomplete to avoid confusion. So going again back to what Sarah said is, in the most recent 2 to 3 week window, based on deaths by date that they occurred, we should shade that out and at least let people know these numbers are likely to rise substantially over the coming weeks as we learn of those deaths that occurred. So to me, I want to see both of them. And no matter what you present, you should have clear context for what the user is reading.
Sarah, is the state of Florida reporting both sets of data?
No. And I think this context point is the most interesting part. Florida used to report both sets of data. Those data were available through their data download portal on the Florida Department of Health website. It allowed researchers and journalists to make the decision, which one do we want to use for which purpose? Are we looking for long-term trends? Are we looking for a snapshot of the recent times? That no longer exists. What happened on August 10th with the Florida Department of Health data as presented by the CDC is even though the data looked the same, and I want to emphasize this, the field names, those column names in the spreadsheet looked the same. They said new deaths, as in every day had new deaths. The previous day on August 9th, that meant new deaths by report date. And on August 10th, it meant new deaths by death date, which completely changes. If you were to just chart the same data, it completely changes that final trend. And there was not transparency around the move. There is no indication of that. Here's another example. On the weekly reports from the Florida Department of Health, it does appear that they are using also the date of death on those reports and have been for some time. But the only reason I say that is because I see that decline in the last 2 weeks where I would expect to see an increase right now. It's actually not defined at all on the weekly reports. Hmm.
So Jason Salemi, the University of South Florida epidemiologist, how is one to see through this, all of this data in order to make personal decisions? For instance, parents, talking about, do they send their child to soccer practice with or without a mask, or swimming practice, or band practice, choir, go to church, the grocery store, all these little decisions that we're all weighing and having to make day in and day out?
Yeah, that's a great question, Tom. I do want to offer one point of clarification is that, even though it is true, what we're getting from the CDC is now deaths by date of death, it really is still easy on a periodic basis, including on the weekly reports, to compare cumulative numbers and get both pieces of information, deaths by date that they occurred and deaths by date that they were reported. And that's why, again, on my dashboard, and even in the stories that the Miami Herald might do, you will see our ability to plot both curves. This is more about communication of the information so that people do have the opportunity to make evidence-based decisions. And why is this important for deaths? You might think, well, deaths comes far after the wave of infections. It's because more than any other COVID-19 metric, what's happening with deaths tends to influence people's behavior, like finally deciding to get vaccinated or wearing a mask. And so at the end of the day, I like the change in reporting. I just hope that scientists, reporters, and the Department of Health can offer transparency and help people to understand, because that really underscores all of this. We must earn the respect and trust of people. We must help them to make evidence-based decisions to protect themselves, their families, and their communities by ensuring they have the opportunity to accurately interpret the data. And the last point I would make about that is we can't let the really Herculean efforts of so many overworked people at the State Department of Health to collect and report on these data. We can't let that go by the wayside just because it's not displayed in a way that is complete, accurate, and timely. And so again, I think what underlies all of this discussion is make sure that when you present data to the public, you help them to understand exactly what they're looking at.
Isn't the difficulty in executing that, Sarah, for a data reporter like yourself and others just even trying to communicate it on the radio, that because of the change in the focus of the death data from the State Department of Health, the change that was made, it makes comparisons difficult at best, impossible at worst? In other words, what did this August look like last August?
Well, we're actually, as Dr. Salemi pointed out, we're actually able to create the comparison. We can do it both ways, and we can chart this data both ways by what is provided, so long as we have the definition. And I think that, again, going back to reiterate, is the most important thing. If there is clarity when there are changes made to these data, then we are able to account for them. What happened on August 10th was that there was no immediate clarity. We could tell the numbers shifted dramatically throughout the entire history of the pandemic. There were people hypothesizing early on, you know, that first couple of hours after we saw these drastic changes, that it was probably a shift to using date of death for that metric. But we did not have that confirmation from the Florida Department of Health or the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention immediately. In fact, it took several days before any confirmation came out. And I think that leaves it up to, you know, journalists and researchers to try to make the best guess. And I think that can cause problems because, well, we want to display these data in the most responsible way. If we have to guess at the definition, that creates a problem for everyone involved.
And Jason, intended or not, it erodes that trust that the public needs to have in the health data so that individuals can make decisions.
Absolutely. That goes throughout this pandemic. This is not something that is unique to Florida. There are many people on social media who have tons of followers and who sometimes relay information that's in a disingenuous or maybe just incompetent way. And the more that we get things wrong, and again, this could be because we're not receiving accurate information on how to interpret the data, or we're painting the data in a certain light, you know, nefariously, I think that is what begins to erode trust. Because as soon as you start confusing people and people have to clarify things, then you start asking the question, well, who is the experts here? Who really knows the truth? I can't really trust the data anyway. And it makes it really challenging to then convince people that, hey, if you follow the science, you'll make responsible decisions to protect everybody in your community. So yes, this is the larger theme about all of this is, again, and I try and do that with my dashboard. I spend way more time trying to add context and tooltips and things that make sure that whether you're a researcher, a scientist, somebody from the media, or somebody just from the general public, when you interact with these data, these visualizations, you should understand, or at least have the opportunity to understand what you're looking at.
Let me remind folks that you are listening to the Florida Roundup here on Florida Public Radio. We're speaking with Jason Salemi, University of South Florida epidemiologist, and Sarah Blasky, data specialist for the Miami Herald, about the change in how the state of Florida is reporting deaths from COVID-19, moving from a change that now is reflected in terms of the date that someone has died from the virus. So, Sarah, what does the current data tell us about the state of the virus if we look at the data as reflected in how the Department of Health is now reporting it via the date of death?
So what you will see is that by date of death, you will see a decline in the last 2 weeks of deaths. But again, as Dr. Salemi pointed out, really that part of the graph should be shaded out. It's incomplete data. And the reason that we might be seeing that downturn is, of course, because it's incomplete. Yeah. On the other hand, if you do chart these by the report date, you see deaths increasing and continuing to increase, which again can be and has been historically a litmus test. And I will point to the Miami Herald's recent reporting on daily death numbers. We're looking at about between 250 and 325 new deaths being reported each day. As Dr. Salemi pointed out, that doesn't mean they have died each day, but according to the Miami Herald reporting, about 70 to 75% of those deaths did occur within the last 2 weeks and almost all of them within the last month. So what you're looking at is a very deadly surge, higher death numbers, and we'll have to wait and see as the data backfill by date of death to really understand everything about this particular surge.
As we await for that, Jason, as we're moving into September here again, August was the most deadly month of the pandemic in Florida so far? Is that accurate?
That's absolutely accurate now. So just with the updated data from yesterday, we learned of an additional 1,356 people who had died relative to the previous data update only 3 days prior. And so with that updated data, we learned that we actually just hit a new pandemic high for daily deaths over a 7 day period. That's 245 each day for the past 7 days on August 15th. The previous high from the summer surge of 2020 was 228. And in fact, with this backfill of information, we had 10 straight days from August 12th to August 21st, in which that 7 day average was higher than our previous summer surge. So despite the obvious benefits of COVID-19 vaccines, the fact that we've had these record numbers of cases during the Delta surge, and they led to the highest numbers of hospitalizations in every age group that we have seen in the pandemic thus far, as you might expect, it's ended up resulting in pretty considerable mortality.
Yeah, Jason Salemi, doctor, University of South Florida epidemiologist, and Sarah Blasky, a data scientist for the Miami Herald. To both of you, thanks for joining us here on the Florida Roundup. We're back here on Florida Roundup on Florida Public Media, Florida Public Radio. It is Tom Hudson here in Miami. My co-host Melissa Ross is off this week. Florida is one of several states with new voting laws approved by state legislatures after the 2020 election. Opponents worry the new rules may make voting more difficult. Supporters say the new law here in Florida was necessary to ensure the security of future elections in the Sunshine State. Meantime, prosecutors are investigating alleged problems with the 2020 election in Florida. Ghost candidates. A ghost candidate is someone who appears on a voter's ballot in a race, but really has no genuine interest in actually running for the office, doesn't campaign at all, and is only added to the ballot to confuse voters. One ghost candidate in a Miami-Dade state Senate race has pleaded guilty. A former Republican state senator faces charges in that case, and it is one of three ghost candidates in different races that are being looked at here. 305-995-1800 is our phone number to join our conversation at Florida Roundup on Twitter. Mike Harper is a reporter for the Daytona Beach News Journal. Mike, welcome to the program. Thanks for sharing your reporting with us.
Hi. Yeah. Actually, it's Mark.
That's Mark. Okay. Fair enough. Mark. No, I got it. It's not okay. We got to get that byline correct. Mark, I apologize for that. Sure. Mark, how do these ghosts, you know, speaking of names, right? How do ghost candidates work on ballots?
In this case, let's take the race that's under criminal investigation. A a former state senator approached an old friend, an old colleague, or I mean, an old friend, and asked him, "Hey, if I give you some money, will you run for election?" This is according to the prosecution's arguments.
Right.
And so this gentleman, all he did was sign up to be a candidate and then lay low. And, you know, kind of the way it worked was that the senator, the former state senator, was basically hired as a consultant to be to help get Republicans elected in two key South Florida district races. So that's where he you know, evidently approached the ghost candidate in this case. There's some question as to what happened in the other case, but
yeah.
In any event, the ghost candidate lay low, and in the meantime, there's evidence of the Republican kind of machine working to support this independent candidate by purchasing postcards that would basically say vote for Alex Rodriguez, and the postcards sort of targeted left-leaning right. independent voters, sort of in a scheme to siphon votes away from the Democrat in that race.
And shared the same surname as the ghost candidate, Rodriguez.
Yeah, that was part of it. It helped that it was the same last name, and it helped that it was the name of a famous baseball player, I'm sure.
There may be a little bit of name recognition there, even though obviously different people here with that particular name. What was the impact?
Well, it worked. It worked beautifully for the Republican in that race, because the ghost candidate got about 6,400 votes. And the race was decided by 32 votes, and a Republican named Ileana Garcia upset the incumbent in that race, mm-hmm. Jose Javier Rodriguez.
Right. The Republican won. The Republican was sworn in and served in the state legislature in this last session because of it. And prosecutors, meantime, have continued to look at this case, this ghost candidate, auto parts salesperson, I think is what the day job was of this ghost candidate in this particular case, has made a plea, hasn't he?
Yeah, he pleaded guilty last week to election-related charges, and he's getting probation. He's agreed to testify against the former state senator, Frank Artiles. Mm-hmm. And Artiles is going on trial probably in a couple of months. His trial was delayed. It had originally been scheduled for August 30th.
Yeah, Artiles is the former state senator who prosecutors say was kind of the ringleader, the mastermind behind this particular ghost candidate. But prosecutors have looked at him for other candidates, perhaps, that were not genuinely running for office in the 2020 election, right?
Yeah, there were two other Senate races that had the same sort of fingerprints on them. Senate District 39 and Senate District 9 up here in Central Florida also involved ghost candidates. They also involved the same funding source for the postcards, pretty much the same advertising, almost the same language in all three cases. It all pretty much was, coming from the same source of funding. So,
and have prosecutors been able to follow the money, that old characterization, that old tip to follow the money? Have prosecutors and others been able to follow that down to a source?
Yeah, they're getting closer, I think. I don't know to the degree in which the state attorney here in Central Florida, the one covering Seminole County, is pursuing a case. At this point, all they've said is that the FDLE is sort of reviewing some of the allegations in Central Florida in that particular case. But there seems to be no move to officially call it an investigation.
Yeah. Mark, stick with us. We're speaking with Mark Harper, reporter for the Daytona Beach News Journal. And you're listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. We're talking about prosecutors investigating essentially what amounts to fraud in the 2020 election here in Florida. Not ballot fraud, however, candidate fraud, ghost candidates, candidates recruited allegedly by a former state Republican senator to be spoilers in very tight state legislative races, two in South Florida and one in Central Florida. We're speaking with Mark Harper, reporter for the Daytona Beach News Journal. Mark, lawmakers did take action on voting reforms here in Florida this past legislative session. It didn't address fraud that's alleged to have taken place here, ghost candidates. What do voting rights advocates, voting registration drive supporters make of that?
Well, there's a lot of election experts who would argue that Florida's new laws are basically designed to limit the number of Democrats voting. It sort of cuts into, makes it more difficult for people to, at least it makes it a step more difficult to prove that you are a registered voter, and makes some other measures such as drop boxes less accessible.
That's what this voting legislation does. It's been focused on access to vote by mail ballots, drop boxes, even politicking around polling places and drop boxes and drop box security. But when it comes to where the prosecutors have focused their efforts on election fraud in 2020 toward these ghost candidates, is there existing law for the, or is it just outright fraud that's already on the books that prosecutors are using?
Well, there's some question. I mean, there's not really a law that says you can't be a ghost candidate. Anybody has the right to, file as a candidate for election, and anybody has a right to campaign or not campaign as they see fit. The law, the legal part of this, the criminal part of this comes in when you look at, paying somebody to be a ghost candidate, or conspiring to put a ghost candidate on the ballot and siphon votes away. So those two charges that Artiles is facing primarily are for his involvement in paying Alex Rodriguez something like $44,000to run, and there's a conspiracy related charge.
What's the state of that investigation in Central Florida that you've been following?
Well, the state attorney's office in Seminole County is not commenting on their process. All we've heard really is that the Florida Department of Law Enforcement is taking a look at some of the allegations and reviewing that with the Seminole County state attorney. So at this point, we're not really sure if there's going to be an investigation if it's simply, a review. I mean, there have been calls for the state attorney to investigate and to you know, to pursue charges against some of the people involved here.
One of the listeners tweeting us here, Mark, so will there be any real consequences for the person who orchestrated this, or will he just get a slap on the wrist? We'll have to wait and see there. Mark, thank you for sharing your reporting. We got to run here. Sorry to cut you off there at the last moment there. Mark Harper, reporter for the Daytona Beach News Journal. That'll do it for our program today. It is produced by WJCT Public Media in Jacksonville, WLRN Public Media in Miami, Heather Schatz and Andrea Perdomo, the producers, Catherine Hobbs, associate producer, WLRN's director of radio operations, and our technical director is Peter Meritz. Engineering help each and every week from Doug Peterson, Charles Michaels, and Josh Torres. Richard Ives answers the phones. Theme music for Miami jazz guitarist Aaron Libos at aaronlibos.com. Have a great weekend.